Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Unspun, episode 84. I'm back with Dr. Hans Utter today. Hans, thanks for coming on. We've got more good information to present, more research that Hans discovered this week. And, thanks everyone who supported the show this last week. I really appreciate it. And also, there was a very interesting thread on Facebook that went off this week. I'm going to be linking it in the chat room today for people to check out. They'll definitely want to study that whole thing. I'll leave it at that, but folks will definitely want to read that. Hans, welcome back to the show. How have you been this week?
Pretty good, man. Doing well. I'm going to be just keeping up with everything that's going on, or trying not to keep up with it. Lots of rainstorms and perhaps brainstorms going on.
Rainstorms and brainstorms. How about that? We had some rainstorms and brainstorms around here too.
Yep. Yeah. So everything's good, and what do you say? I'm in the heart of the Midwest here in Columbus, Ohio, and I'd like to thank, I did receive a few donations from last week's show. I'd like to thank everybody for that. Definitely appreciate it.
Excellent. Well, and apparently the signal is pretty awful tonight, so I don't know what is up with that. I'm going to need to call somebody and try to get that taken care of, because it wasn't so bad not too long ago, and last week it wasn't too bad, and today we're actually getting really low kilobytes per second, like 773 right now, and that's with just about everything else externally shut off here. We're dealing with it, folks. We're doing the best we can with what we've got, anyway.
Interestingly enough, as I was delving into stuff, I started to hit on certain points and things like that. I started getting all kinds of weird issues. I have four or five computers here, but pretty much across the board. So it's been a bit frustrating here trying to get stuff up and running. But I guess that's what happens. Maybe it's mind over matter. It's just a coincidence, probably.
Well, maybe this is just a coincidence too, but a couple weeks ago, Steve Outram and I were doing a show on Burning Man, and we kept getting cut off every 20, 30 minutes during the whole show, and kept having to restart the whole thing, restart the stream and all of that to YouTube. And as I'm talking about it, it almost shut off right then. But I say it's like 2 hours, 3 hours into this 5 hour long episode, and I just scream at the Intel community to knock it off. If they don't want to get exposed, they should stop the behavior. We didn't have a single another drop the rest of the show after that. Like I said, call it a coincidence, but sure is an interesting one nonetheless. So what are we going to discuss tonight?
Well, Jan, I'm just going to keep diving into this subject. It turns out to be quite interesting. And I think, as I mentioned last week, it was kind of just, my interest has kind of peaked just because I've been thinking a lot about time, temporal perception, how that is changed, how it's manipulated. And just to review a bit, I talked a bit about the relationship of ourselves to our, you could say, it's more than our timeline, right? You have a timeline, but you have a connection of yourself in the present, capable of action, being aware of your surroundings, but yet connected or disconnected from the past, or trapped in the past, or connected with the natural sort of unfolding process of the future. Or you can also have an experience of the future where you have all these images and everything's crowding you, which creates this sort of information overload, which can be just as debilitating as being caught in the past or being, stuck in the future. And that's kind of like the stress, right? So this is all of these things, what I've found that's really been fascinating. And I kind of just, go with certain ideas. And a lot of times I'll find stuff on my own, and probably other people have looked into it. But this particular topic, it kind of ties into a lot of this old research in psychology And what's very interesting is I started to see these different parallels. And I brought up Kurt Lewin, right? I pronounce it right. Kurt Lewin. Should be like a little band come out playing, you know.
Yeah. Hey, he got it right. How many times did you say it wrong before? Like 10?
I don't know. Probably 100. Like, I literally couldn't say the name right. I've even talked to people just in conversation. I was like, man, it's like a mind virus, which we'll get into. But what's extremely fascinating is that the sense of what I mean time is really, it's your narrative, but it's you know, it's a very, you could say it's a complex yet sort of a simple thing that we all experience, but most of the time we're not aware of it. And this can also certainly be deployed on a societal level as well as an individual level. And what's been interesting is to find that Muzak uses the term sonic topologies. So, okay, we have psychological topology, we have sonic topologies. And I've sort of long suspected that in order to, you know, try to, you know, for these things to be engaged as systematic patterns, right, as opposed to simply just random occurrences or, you know, based on capitalists, you know, trying to sell records or whatever, you really need a model that relates the spatial element that we inhabit with the psychological element. And so as I looked into this, I found out that there's earlier formulations of the present as social, right? In the present, you are related. You are connected. The present is, in a sense, the social or cultural sphere that we inhabit. And just in myself, I'm noticing, you know, the acceleration of time. It's like, it's really weird. Like I try to do this NLP technique called, like, you know, temporal warping or something, and with Bandler, and I felt like, you know, that wasn't too good. But, you know, there's different ways to slow down our perceptions of time, but primarily it's a way of locating ourselves, right, in an environment that has meaning, with the history, with a way to engage in the present. But within these three categories of sort of temporal dissociation or dislocation, you know, being in the present, right? As I talked about last week, like Frankie Goes to Hollywood, the Pleasure Dome, you know what the song Relax, Don't Do It is about, right? I'm sure you do. It's about proper anal sex technique. If anyone knew that wonderful song, Relax, Don't Do It, that's the thematic material, but the Pleasure Dome, or just the present moment thing, which can be quite a lot of fun, right? That's a lot of the 1960s counterculture was in this present, but you cannot really create long-term plans. You're not able to formulate goals and realize those goals, right? So in a certain way, you're dislocated from this experience. And again, it's extremely interesting to see that all of these things are connected, but what makes it both complex and very interesting, it goes from the level of individual experience to the neurological functions of music to the creation of the entire sort of artificial cultural sphere that we inhabit. And as I've seen discovered in the past couple of days, also into the counter movement against that, which in this case, I'll talk primarily about William S. Burroughs, who in his own very, you know, almost very encoded way, really described this process in a way that very few have done. But at the same time, his methodology of liberation is really a much more of a trap. So, you know, as we go into this topic, I just bring up a couple of things here in that.
Hey, Hans, can you continue for a second? I've got somebody's standing outside my front door talking really loud. And can you just keep going while I go take, huh?
Yeah, sure. I'm like a kid. Left.
Thanks. Just keep going. I'll be right back. Sorry for the interruption, folks.
Yeah. So anyways, as I was saying, you know, we look at William S. Burroughs as sort of one of these heroes of the counterculture, but his method of liberation, even though he has a very intricate and in some ways very disturbing description of the entire warping of reality through electronic memory through other types of means. His method of liberation has a lot in common with a variety of sort of mind control techniques and things like that. And so when we look at ourselves in time, it is a sense of place, right? So it's a location. We're located in not just a physical location, but in a place that has meaning, that we're connected to or disconnected. And music has a lot to do with that, especially with the deployment of what I've started to kind of figure out how this would work, the deployment of these self-replicating signs that function primarily through the means of repetition. And that's a big part of this recycling of the culture and the recycling of these historical periods, right? And I'm trying to get some actual statistics on this, like the retromania. You know, most of the time it's seen as either, oh, we've run out of ideas, or it's just this, you know, we're just trying to be cool and we're just going back. But one thing to note is that from the, you know, if you look at, say, starting in the late 70s, and when you have people looking back to the 1950s, you know, you've got like American Graffiti, Happy Days, you even have some of the punk rock groups that are connecting with 1950s rockabilly, you know, like the Cramps, et cetera. And so this is, you have a pretty good gap of time. You're talking about 30 years, right? Now we're looking at 90s music, 80s music, like I, you know, 90s, you know, going back to 2005. And now it's these cycles of you know, this recycling of culture has really hit a kind of a frenetic pace. And so in order to pull this out into some sort of coherent way of understanding it, I'll just start by, and Jan, please feel free to chime in here at any point. I'll start by just looking at some of the effects of what we call background sound or background simulation, right? So from the quantum methodologies of the Muzak Corporation, which basically saved the company from extinction by connecting with all these grunge rock guys and starting to use all these popular songs, right? They create an individual sonic profile for a specific location. They look at the topology of a song, a sonic topology, which relates to all of its historical cultural associations, influence on people in that environment. And then you have all these levels of cognitive influence, right? So we'll start by looking at the fact that music not only is a very important demarcation of memory, right? So if you listen to a song, oh, they're playing our song, common way of looking at that. Oh, I remember this, or I can bring back. You might even remember a smell. You know, it's because, again, it works on both sides of the brain. It really encodes things in a very complex way. So in a certain way, it really is a miniature model of the individual as they relate to society, as well as they relate to, using, you know, the term of agency, which, or emplacement, which means you're in a place which is not just a physical place, but it's a place in the world, in the time stream, in the environment where you are able to take action, where you are not caught up in any of these types of manipulations. But so some of these different studies, one of the first things is that music changes how we can encode or listen to or understand meaning, right? How we encode our memories. So such factors as the time, the type of beats per minute, the speed of a song, certain types of harmonics, things like that, can influence how we even create and encode memories. So not only, you know, you can have a song again with a, you know, with the personal reference point of, oh, this is our song, right? And you have a song like The Wedding March, which, you know, that always calls to mind the association of weddings. But on a neurological level, it starts and can affect our ability to learn, to solve complex problems, and even how, what we notice and what we miss, right? Because it starts to create this what's known as temporal binding, which is a window where we start to cue our perceptions to these beats, right? And then, you know, going through the pop music and looking at if you look at it as a big scatter chart, you can see a huge diversity of different types of rhythms and, you know, things like that, right? And as you go further out in time, it gets more and more narrow, such as that you can find 78% of like 2000 pop songs are all using, you know, in the same key, using very similar beats per minute placements. And this something is called the earbug, which is where you get a song stuck in your head, right? And I don't have a chance to send you the link, but I found a link of, you know, kind of a science thing talking about the earbug, and they made this song, and it was designed to get caught in your head, but try to solve the maze while listening to this. And this is very good because if you remember the song while you're trying to solve the maze, this will increase your cognitive capacity or whatever. But in the case of that particular song and the kind of maze you're trying to solve, and it's just like, I remember that show, The Maze, you know, back on the, you know, the whole Grateful Dead thing. This maze is this other metaphor or model for basically what it is like to be stuck in this sort of fractured or sort of disembedded temporal, you know, having yourself temporally fragmented. And so this is one aspect. Another aspect is that music can produce cognitive interference, right? They've looked at certain types of music and how it works for, like, you're trying to read, you're trying to formulate tasks, you're trying to formulate.
Oh, I just lost you, Hans. You there?
Yeah, I'm here.
All right. You cut out for about 5 seconds there. Go back a little bit.
Yeah. Okay. So I was talking about this, types of background music and how certain types of music will absolutely interfere with reading comprehension. So it interferes with your ability not only to understand what you're reading, but to be able to remember it, to be able to analyze it, to be able to, it basically, and then there's a bunch of reasons for this, right, which I'll get into a little bit, not too much, but it's known as capacity interference. So this capacity interference affects the cognitive capacity in the case of reading, and it also can influence the arousal level. So if the arousal level, arousal meaning, you know, your energy level, all this stuff is too high, that's also going to diminish your ability to be calm, to be able to read, and to be able to sort of go through like what you're looking at, right? And so there's a whole bunch of different studies on this. I won't go through all of them, but and then, you know, on the other hand, there's, of course, this thing of listening to like Baroque music, listening to classical music and things like that, right? And this has a very good, you know, can have a very good effect on how we, you know, how we're able to basically learn. It will slow us down a little bit, but also it will provide a type of a grounding that actually allows the mind to function better, right? So just again to state this, so this is not on a level, this is not on the personal associational level, right? This is not, you hear a song, which is that's a deeper level. So just level one, we just talk about actually the way the brain works, that, you know, the impact of how it influences our ability to process and understand and basically to function on a certain level. Now, if you know, if you're in Iraq and about ready to, you know, you're in your tank and you put on some really loud rock music and you're on a bunch of speed, that's probably going to help you fulfill your function, right? You drive around with a machine gun and you're in that kind of environment. Certainly you're not going to want to put on, you know, Beethoven or something. But, and this is, there's a huge array of task related impacts of music. And one of them being Flight of the Valkyries, right? Which is connected in all these commercials with driving. It's actually some of the worst music to listen to when you're driving, supposedly. So you have a much higher potential to get in an accident listening to that music. So you know, again, we can talk about mood and other things like that, but this is primary task performance, but it is this idea of temporal binding in our ability to connect events in the past, right? And just to go, I'll come back to this in a bit, but this idea of the temporal control, right, which is used in stimulus response conditioning, is that duration between the stimuli, right, which is the conditioned stimuli and the conditioned response. And that entire period is called the temporal control. So during that period of time, that temporal control is exerting influence on the subject, right? So the temporal control is a sort of a specific term, but the way that temporal control works when it's not manipulated is that it's how we see one thing, we connect it with a past event, we're able to follow a train of thought, we're able to, you know, connect with our environments, and we're able to function in such a way that, and you know, and it shouldn't be a big task, it should just be natural. And I think this has been interfered with in a whole array of areas. And so I don't know if you want to throw something in there, but
not really, just listening along.
Okay. Yeah. So I'm just throwing out the sort of the science stuff here, and I won't get too deep into it because it's pretty fascinating, because it actually, these principles go to the level of genetic, of DNA activation or inactivation. They go to the neuronal level. They go to the personality level. They go to the level also of ourselves and our own personal timelines or narratives, right? Or how we're, you know, relating ourselves in the present, not in this now, which is all already gone, right? But you can't get out of the present. But, you know, I mean, this is something I think we all can connect with this. You know, if you're, something bad happened to you and you're focused on the past, you're stuck in the past, or, you know, you have this relationship to the future where you're constantly compressing everything. You're not really able to see your past resources and things like that, right? And again, on a cultural level, if you see yourself and your family heritage in a certain way, if I say I see my family, you know, going back to, you know, I can't do the lizard joke, just in case people think I'm a lizard, I'd say the ancient lizard sect in West Africa. Now, going back to Germany and see, yeah, you guys got me, see my eyes. But anyways, you know, I can see myself as being connected to this rich Germanic tradition, going back to Greco-Roman culture, and embrace that and see my life as a continuation of that and connect with that in so many different ways and identify with the benefits and say all these advances and stuff came. And I can, and that's absolutely going to influence how I see myself in the present and what actions I feel I can take or not take. If I look at my past and see myself as, you know, guilt-ridden, you know, as the heir to, you know, all these woes in the world and, you know, slavery and everything else. You know, whatever you want to say, this can absolutely shape a culture. So an entire society can be thrown into a particular state of mind where the society will start to destroy itself. It will no longer be able to be in the present and operate in a meaningful way in the present, able to set long-term goals, able to navigate these things. And when it's naturally working, things will flow very smoothly. And so this is an example also, you know, when you look at the destruction of history, what you're looking at is an erasure of the past, and you're going into this sort of this dome that I mentioned, you know, this dome, and I have my own kind of thinking about it.
Just to interject, did you have a chance to check out any of the shows with Jacob Duhlman where we discuss the changing of time and history and all of that? I mean, that's basically the time machine once you get the joke, you know, going back and just changing what something says, and just like in Back to the Future, it ripples forward through time. That's exactly what they've done. It's just rewriting the books and using the music and all of this stuff to do it.
Yeah, yeah. And what's very interesting about this, though, is that it functions on the level of our external perceptions, but more pernaciously, it can create these embedded systems and networks in our own minds that we're not even aware of. And I think that this can be operating, not to get too complex here, but you look at there's one model, sort of the embodied cognition model, you look at these multiple oscillation cycles, right? There's a whole array of different temporal cycles we're inhabiting, everything from our heartbeat to our, you know, natural environment to our sense of the historical time, et cetera, et cetera. So this also influences psychological space or inner space, which is something that, you know, the psychonauts will go there and explore that for us. And maybe we've done a bit of that ourselves, but, So anyways, yeah, so this is something that in order to sort of hopefully, you know, feel free to interject here because I'll just throw out a few more terms and I won't go into it. There's synchronous and asynchronous control. This is control over time exerted by conditioned stimulus response. Synchronous and asynchronous control. So this is a control of time itself in the individual's perception, right? And music, in fact, is one of the most important means of manipulating our sense of time, right? So our sense of time is often controlled, conditioned in ways that we're not even aware of, right? We're not aware, especially as we get so much caught up in this sort of external clock, you know, this time, motion, and velocity Newtonian clock. We forget that, you know, we have our, what we perceive in time is absolutely subjective. And when that's cut off, fragmented, or broken, or manipulated with various types of delayed conditional responses. This actually hijacks how we see the world, right? Your sense of time is going to absolutely influence what you're seeing. If you're, you know, the great quote is you slow down to speed up. If you're going slowly, you're able to see things actually much more rapidly. You can catch things that are happening very quickly, right? If your sense of time is sped up, you're going to miss a huge array of things from the environment. And in fact, it's also possible to operate in a very conditioned or unaware type of situation. So basically though, that music affects, but it also affects what we expect, right? So this idea of repetition, the idea of you condition an audience to very short songs. You condition audiences, sorry about the lips there, the techno beat. I mean, that beat, what is that beat doing? It's completely, now you're in, so you can get this sort of access of right being in the present moment, but it's just completely, you know, it's melting your future agency, and it's disconnecting you from the past. And when you're taking ecstasy and you go into these tribal situations, it starts to create an unconscious cognitive bias for these types of situations, and it cuts and slices your ability for temporal control to relate yourself from, you know, within the present, but connecting with past, future. And this can even go for making a salad or something. You know, you heard the term etards, you know, as you become an etard, that's one of the things that happens. But this can start to affect the
entire etard as an ecstasy tard.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, but per MAPS and everybody, it's totally safe and doesn't do any damage.
Yeah, exactly. So, I'm going to stay away from some of this more science stuff, which is super interesting, though, forward and basking, backward masking, temporal stimuli, whatever. But so just this guy, Osgood, you know, he talks about this self-conversion, right? Which is the way you become your own agent of brainwashing, so to speak, right? So they're able to, there's a mechanism that becomes set up in your own consciousness that allows for different types of stimuli to come in and affect or condition you in a variety of ways. And in fact, that's one of the things which I'll talk about you and Cameron. That's one of the things that he was trying to do. But the funny thing about him is, you know, you look, he's like this jolly old Scotsman, you know, from this ancient, you know, hereditary family of lords, and he was athletic and loved sports and just loved a good time, and he's always talking about how much he cared about patients and wanted to change the world. And there's so much apologist stuff about him that really describes him as just this jolly old fellow who was just trying to help people, and that's how he framed it. So he talked about how to implant this type of mechanism that it starts to become self-replicating or else can be triggered by other related types of mechanisms. And making sure I'm not going too fast here, you go to Kurt Lewin. It's the third time I said, all right. So psychological topology, even though this is not really used that much, right? This gives us a way, how do you model an individual psychic space within a social environment within all the different types of actors and players and different stimuli and historical whatever events. Well, this is offers an amazing mean to do that. And again, I don't think it's any accident that the Muzak company is now using that terminology of topology. But, and I just mentioned this guy Schillinger, which is, he was a musicologist. And another guy that sort of disappeared, this, you know, I mean, he had very interesting work, but he talked about the perception of time, psychological time and clock time, and he calls it temporal saturation, right? So this idea of temporal saturation. So this is a little bit of what, you know, what we're sort of looking at as we go into these areas. So
let me ask Hans, is it sort of like... you know, when you're tapping along to music or your foot starts going, you're nodding your head along and you don't recognize it, that's actually a trance state. It's a state of hypnosis. Is that how they get it, or is it, you know?
No, not necessarily. I mean, that's called basic entrainment, right? So rhythmic entrainment. And in fact, if you're tapping along and listening to it, it means that you're actually conscious of that. I mean, and you know, you may be tapping, but most of this stuff I'm talking about is where this is more in this idea of the background music, the cultural background. And so that tapping along response, that you describe that as a gross or corporeal, you know, embodied type of response, which means that at least, you know, you have some degree of awareness that this stimuli is affecting you. Yes, that can be a part of it, but you know, what I'm, you know, talking about is, you know, this is why I said it's a bit dense in a certain way, but I think it's super interesting because, you know, what we're looking at is a connection between social space, right? There's a book by Edward T. Hall, The Hidden Dimension, and he talks about hormonal space within the body and hormonal space within a social environment, right? So our endocrine, all of our glands and all this stuff are being influenced by not only the types of space that we're in, right? But also by the people around us and how these things can all interplay. So there's sort of an extension of the orgasm or orgasm. Extension of the organism.
Yeah, you know what? We're going to have to kill the feed and restart it because it's given a lot of trouble. So we just had four people mention it, so I'm stopped. All right, sorry about that, Hans. It's back on. Hopefully it's running now, so we'll see. And, well, it seems to be, well, now it's even worse. Yeah, Canada says down. One person is saying it's back now.
Okay.
Yeah, they're saying Google must hate you on so much. Yep. Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here, man.
All right, so let's go. It seems to be a little bit better. Try it again. Sorry about that.
Okay, so
you're talking about orgasms.
I meant to say organism.
Oh, organisms. All right, so we were talking about organisms in music. Not orgasms in music.
You know, well, music, what I'm talking about is, again, we can always, I'm happy to sort of, you know, unpack this a bit more, but this idea that the social space is also, it affects our bodies, but then our bodies will affect the bodies of other people, right? So, and then this is a visual perception, but also sound, right? The connection of sound to space. And in fact, sound can be far more important in terms of our encoding of visual stimuli than the visual stimuli itself, right? So that's why the use of this manipulation, the recycling of cultural material and other things like that is so important that you know, again, and this is some of these things I think, you know, they're concepts I should probably, you know, clarify when it's my own type of thinking, but this is something that was part of the literature and the human ecology. I mean, that's exactly what that is. It's human ecology, right? So the human ecology is
The Human Ecology Fund funded MK Ultra. So there you have it.
Well, yeah, exactly. Yeah. So anyways, let's step back here and then let's look at one of the biggest critics of this process, so to speak, a guy who, you know, talked about it in pretty extravagant terms, right? This is William S. Burroughs. I'm just going to read a wonderful quote. The first use of the term heavy metal associated with music, quote, with their...
Right when you
diseases
went to,
and orgasms.
Hans, you're going to have to start that over, you know, and, you know, Steve just says they're messing with us hard. But right when you started to say that, you cut out. So try it again.
Okay. So this is William S. Burroughs.
And tell folks, knock it the hell off, please, you know.
Yeah, guys, come on, man.
Come on. Grow up. Play fair. Go ahead.
All right. Quote, with their diseases and orgasm drugs and their sexless parasite life forms, heavy metal people of Uranus wrapped in cool blue mist of vaporized banknotes. First use of the term heavy metal. Now, it's quite complex. Orgasm drugs and sexless parasite life forms. But within William S. Burroughs' writing, which I'll do a little brief bio of him, in a second here, William S. Burroughs, one of his primary contentions was that we are, in a sense, soft machines. We are machines that we're locked into pre-recorded patterns by the viral self-replicating phenomena of cultural life, of pop culture, of pop songs. And in fact, well, this is a meme, but basically we are caught into a pre-recorded future. We are dissociated and disconnected from any type of actual experience of life through this type of mind parasite, which he gets into in quite a lot of detail. But in fact, William S. Burroughs wanted to form a rock group called the Mind Parasites, interestingly enough. But William S. Burroughs, it turns out to be extremely important as a theorist of this, as well as someone who is devising means to rupture this, quote unquote, rupture this control mechanism. The whole goal was to shatter the word. The word is a prison. You must shatter the word. You must shatter all these associational referential meanings. And a lot of different means for that. One of them is cut up, where you fragment reality, you put it back in different places, you juxtapose it, you shatter that thread. And by doing that, supposedly you can suspend the virus, the mind virus, which in a sense we're caught up. We're basically, as he says, human beings are not even alive. They're just tape recorders that are completely programmed in this artificial reality system, which is a self-replicating network and matrix that uses the emblems and means of popular culture to create this control system. And interesting thing, just another, you know, he talked a lot about science. He knew all about infrasound, all these different things. But another quote from Burroughs, video sonic, inertial guidance units, voice integrators, direct view control systems, inner vowel meter computers. This is in, you know, early 50s. He's talking about inserted type of computer, remote control computer, you know, controlling people via, you know, types of frequency manipulation, implanted electrodes, et cetera, et cetera. But Burroughs is so important because he was really kind of the grandfather, the big daddy of the beat movement, right? He was the experienced older man who was, lived hard out on the streets. He was a junkie. He was a, you know, homosexual, or, you know, he was into sodomy quite a bit. And he shot his wife in the head when they were playing William Tell. But he started writing at age 35, and he's famous for his use of the word as a weapon to destroy itself. Right. So what he did when he wrote Naked Lunch is he wrote the text and then he cut it apart and glued it back together. Or supposedly that's what he did. So this cut up method is supposed to rupture this control system, but by destroying the word, the prison of thought and language. Right. and, you know, things like the Dream Machine, which uses strobic light techniques to go in the hallucinatory states, use of peyote, DMT, ecstasy, et cetera, et cetera. So he, you know, pushing the boundaries of this was the way to liberate yourself by fracturing your perceptions. There's enough. But so that's basically kind of the story of William S. Burroughs, you know, kind of this guy. Now, of course, he's from the Burroughs family that invented the Burroughs adding machine, right? So the Burroughs adding machine was kind of one of the precursors to the computer. One of his uncles was the PR man for Rockefeller and Standard Oil. And then it turns out that, wow, you know, if you dig a little deeper, it turns out that William S. Burroughs was a Harvard graduate. He went to Harvard, and he basically says, oh, I didn't like it there much. And he says, when I was there, I got an interest in witchcraft, and I didn't like Harvard. I couldn't hang with the, he doesn't use the word hang. He's pretty articulate in his own strange way. But he said, I didn't like the whole artificiality of academia. But then occasionally he lets it slip, oh, I did study graduate level anthropology as well. And then suddenly after that, he kind of zooms into profile as this major older man who instigates and integrates the beat movement. He's far more intellectual and not quite as, flipped out as, say, Allen Ginsberg, but also, of course, into pedophilia and all that stuff. But he also became...
Pedophilia, murder, assassinations... promoting drugs for the CIA, all of that good stuff.
Yeah. So with William S. Burroughs, what we see here is someone who's offering in a pretty intellectual way, right? This means of freeing ourselves from this conditioned matrices, right? And so in 1961, Timothy Leary met Burroughs in, I think, Tangiers and brought him some LSD and told Burroughs, and supposedly Burroughs didn't, you know, he said, well, I didn't like the game of old Leary. He was a straight, you know, whatever he said about Leary, but Leary told him that, why don't you tone down your cut up? It's too much for the audience, right? General audience. But anyways, so is, you know, Burroughs, I'm going to do a slight tangent here before I get into you and Cameron, but there's another very important movie which came out, the date, it's called the Ipcress Files. I think it's 1962. And this movie is about mind programming, right? There's a light and sound box that's used with electronic stimuli to basically, you know, for this type of mind control or mind programming. At the same time, this had a lot of psychedelic, pre-psychedelic stuff going on there. It kind of influenced the whole articulation of the whole 60s, you know, counterculture. And very similar to that, in this movie, which was designed from the Knowledge Box, which was this box, they designed the set for this mind control box or machine from this thing in Time Life magazine called the Knowledge Box. And it's quite detailed. The programming box connected, it basically goes into a lot of things about brainwave entrainment, talks about neurological entrainment, and the use of frequency electronic music to program the mind. And it is interesting that they say in the film, well, the Gestapo and whatever they used to physically torture people were much more beyond that. We're now programming the brain waves and using sound to do that, right? And so it, in this way, though, the disintegration of the personality, this is very much aligned with even modern technologies. In some ways, you could say it sort of told the future, in the idea of this, this spy thing. And we have all these, the whole thing with all the spy movies coming up. And we have the same actor who was in that movie, who's now in this, the new movies, the movie series where they're like in this like British intelligence thing and it's super surreal and really crazy. You know what I'm talking about?
No, I don't.
Okay. Well, people probably know these. I've seen the movies, and one of them, and this same guy is in this movie. These movies, if I remember the name, the new one just came out, basically, is absolutely connected with the recycling of this, right? But the way in this case of this conditioning reflex in the movie The Ypres Files that he escapes is by what they call the transformation of the mind into a cybernetic spectator. So the mind becomes a cybernetic spectator. And at the base of this idea, you cannot escape from culture. You can't really escape from your mental conditioning. But when you become a cybernetic spectator, you can manipulate its effects. You can merge. You can break through. And this is very much connected with what Leary would come out with by this sort of derangement of time and space, and exactly what Burroughs basically talks about. So I keep going here. Yeah. Jump in there. So we see here with Burroughs, we have this very interesting description, you know, of The Kingsman. That's absolutely right.
Thank you, Jacob. Appreciate that.
Yep. It is The Kingsman. And it slipped my mind. So, but what we see is that the development of a lot of these things have been worked on throughout, you know, different, you know, going back even to the early, 20th century, and it sort of goes through different iterations. And this biologic model, you got Minsky and other people like that. And this idea of looking at flickering light. So the book, The Living Brain, in 1953, Walter is a guy that basically influenced Burroughs to use this cut-up technique, or this use of sensory stimuli to fracture images, to fracture temporal perception, to create this state of liberation, right? Then you have the flicker rate, which is also, this goes into technology of television, right? The flicker rate, creating this hypnotic state, or this hypnotic, described as this hypnotic trance producing state. Rereading Burroughs and all this other stuff, what's very interesting is seeing that the technologies that are all deployed in, you know, various types of pop culture, mass culture, that are deployed as means to liberate yourself. In fact, even in the Naropa Institute, he, you know, lectured on writing, you know, many, many people that were trying to sort of break free from society and this extremely dark vision where you're basically you're a conditioned soft machine. You're a flesh robot that is completely bound up by all these different externally constructed stimulus cycles. And these, you know, as I described earlier, they're interacting in other ways with other people.
Right. Cybernetics.
Yeah. Cybernetics, psycho-cybernetics. And so I'm just going to give you an example, how this went into the psychedelic movement, which was very influenced in the cybernetic culture, was very, very important to a lot of this growing counterculture. So this is a psychedelic spokesperson, Michael Hollingshead. He's talking about the event. This is about a psychedelic event. And by the way, Burroughs was they launched some magazine. Burroughs was there with Pink Floyd and the band Soft Machine. Immense influence on popular culture, immense influence on punk rock, immense influence on sort of third stream, you know, things that seem like you finally broken free and now you're free of society. You know how to get out, right? And really being there in these real outposts or fringe outposts. So the quote is here from Hollingshead: "Our purpose here is to expand our awareness. Tonight we shall be mixing auditory and visual phenomena. The brain is capable of processing all this data. It will see different images moving in random planned fashions. Soundtracks, some of which have been cut up, will be heard. Films and light will perform. All you have to do is focus on one point, and then you will see the rest. Diversity will be unity, but do not try to understand. The brain will do all of that later. Here you will have 10,000 visions. Sit back and relax. Extend yourself to an anesthetic difference, which is, of course, the cybernetic, you know, I just mentioned already, cybernetic spectator. You have the opportunity of leaving your body, leaving your mind. You're going on a voyage. The price of admission is your mind. For if you attempt to analyze and conceptualize, you will cheat yourself in order to see things in a fresh manner. So this, you know, the cybernetic programming, or this idea that you will derange, you will shatter the programming influence of society, which is a self-replicating virus. It's a viral entity. It is an entity with autonomy that basically, you know, there's a lot of pretty graphic, you know, sexual stuff in Burroughs. You have to get through it. I mean, he has a, you know, but this idea of just this complete destruction, debasement, but also this sensory overload, and the shattering is the only way you can break free from your entire mind. But it's basically saying your entire mind is a virus, right? The entirety of human culture is this self-replicating organism that you're basically controlled. You're under the control of all these externally operating systems that have become ingrained in your own mental patterning, right? That are triggered by phenomena such as popular music, as especially through the repetition of popular songs. And this works to remove, in fact, it creates the future, right? This is a way of creating a future by controlling this temporal perception, right? This temporal present is being controlled. And one of the ways this is done, again, is through this, you know, relatively sort of complex process. But go ahead and chime in there, I think.
Oh, well, you know, it was just like you were saying last week, you're walking down the street in India and every corner's got this freaking, you know, classic rock band playing, which isn't even part of their culture. You know, so they're engaging that apparently. Got to crank up the pop music.
Yeah, and this is not an isolated phenomenon, right? But it's very much connected to a lot of other social factors and social forces. But I think that this idea of this triggering mechanism and the effect it has on our ability to experience time, especially when how we experience the world around us, how we, you know, see ourselves spatially, how we interact. You know, this is why the use of these popular songs, this repetition, this locking into these types of associational topologies or repeating cycles. You know, as I mentioned that, you know, if you look, you can see human function as a type of nested oscillators, or, you know, different types of cycles. Now you start to put things on different layers, right? From the biological level to the emotional level to even how we encode ourselves in relationship, how we relate to other people, how we talk to people, how we listen, how we read, how we even see what the world is around us and what we can do in it. So it's that deep. So as I'm saying, in a sense, Burroughs is not really that far off the mark, even though it sounds kind of terrifying. But in a certain way, I think that this is something that is ongoing. And I just want to read a couple quotes from Burroughs here. This is not from his books. These are from some interviews. But, quote, an elitist world state, very much along the lines laid down by the Nazis, at the top would be a theocracy trained in psychic control techniques implemented by computerized electronic devices that would render opposition psychologically impossible. In short, you don't get in by merit or ability, but by being an all-around 100% shit. The elite lives happily ever after at the top of a control state that makes 1984 seem cozy and nostalgic. So, and you can see Burroughs maybe have been 100% shit, which I'll go through here. So, okay.
When did Burroughs write that?
This is in an interview. And this is in, this is a Paris Review. I think this is, I think it's the late 50s.
Is that the one where he's talking about the Mayan calendar as a system of social control?
Well, he brings that up quite a bit, right?
So yeah, so I cite that article. That's interesting. And, you know, what's also interesting that he says that because he's working under Aldous Huxley with MKUltra and all of this, but Eric Blair, George Orwell was a student under Aldous Huxley, and both of those guys were Fabians. So just another, you know, connection there with that.
Yeah, yeah. And so a few more from some different interviews.
Sure.
The question is, do you think human beings are even alive? Bros, they're not even alive. They're talking tape recorders. It's not a question of eliminating human beings. It's a question of eliminating walking tape recorders. Okay, and then he's talking about control, how control mechanism works. Well, they wouldn't have to be telepathic. They could do that with microphones, sort of subliminal microphones. As to how effective these suggestions would be, I just don't know. All these people are talking about hearing voices, telling them to do things. Now, where do all these voices come from? Well, this is one of the symptoms, of course, of schizophrenia. And we now know that the voices come from a non-dominant brain hemisphere, whatever that is. In fact, you can produce voices by electrical stimulation of the non-dominant brain hemisphere in normal subjects. So that's the line to take. If you can get it into the non-dominant brain hemisphere, then it has this terrific power. People can't disobey it, but only certain people would be subject to that type of conditioning. And then I took out the question. It's another response from Bros. And he's talking about viruses. He's talking about human beings themselves as being these viral entities that are, in a sense, hosts for this language virus or this thought virus, this sound virus. Oh, yes, that's the viral theory of evolution. It's finding more and more credence. The virus changes in several generations, which would then be genetically conveyed. It's quite a respectable theory of evolution at the present time. They're getting further and further away from Darwin and coming to tentative conclusions that evolutionary change is biological mutation over one or two generations, possibly through a virus. No virus we know at the present time acts in this way. That is to say, would affect biologic alterations than genetics. But such a virus may have existed in the past. I'll keep going here. So that's some quite interesting stuff.
How much more do you have? Because we're just about at the end here.
Okay. Well, I don't know if we have to do any more on this here. I got quite a lot. But I just try not to rush through it so people could kind of follow.
Yeah. Right.
But anyway, so with Burroughs, what you find is that you and Cameron talked about using tape recorders in psychological practice in 1951, right? So this first started the use. So for Burroughs, which I didn't read the passage, for Burroughs, the use of the tape recorder to slow down, speed up time, to change environmental stimuli, to pipe in different sounds, to manipulate your own perception of reality with, you know, two different tape recorders playing the same conversation at different speeds, to fracture your own reality, to fracture your own sense of past and future. This was being done exact same thing, except not done as an artistic means or as a means of self-liberation from the control grid that is going through this entire deployment of sound, images, words, popular culture, history, etc. But this is exactly what Burroughs is doing, except he's doing it just a few years later, right?
Did he write that or say that by chance just before like the Beatles White Album came out?
Yes, he did. Yeah, it does. Oh, well, a lot of this, I didn't get all the dates, but a lot of the stuff came out because he rewrote. Well, this trilogy is called the Nova Trilogy, right? Where he talks mostly about music. And what's very interesting is he uses this idea of Tin Pan Alley songs as a locus of spatial temporal mind control, functioning in a way as a viral way. So there's this thing, Johnny Didn't Come Home from the Carnival, whatever, which is a song from the 30s. And this showed up in a movie et cetera. And he traces this whole, the carousel. The carousel is like this spinning circle, right? So he uses this idea of these pop songs as containing this sort of self-sustaining life force that gets implanted into our minds and affects how we see. In this case, he talks about the idea of having love, relationships, or this false nostalgia, but at the same time showing up in film, showing up in different iterations throughout culture. And this is, you know, again, this is this book series that he really is clear sort of delineation of this philosophy of control. What's interesting, he revised the books in 1967 and threw in the Beatles and Rolling Stones. He threw them in. The book was written in the 50s, you know, the series.
That's simply because he impacted their albums just like he did with the whole punk scene working with him. And then he goes back and puts them in as examples in his own work of this being done.
Yeah, no, it's not only putting them in, but what he does is he talks about using the popular songs, the new songs. At the beginning of this book, he says, inoculation is a weapon of choice against viruses, and inoculation can only be effected through exposure. Exposures to the pleasures operated under enemy conditions. So he's saying splicing in Rolling Stones and Beatles and stuff into this mind matrix that we're caught up in is a way to sort of disrupt this. At the same time, he's very clearly delineating in a very complex way of how the 30s, 40s, 50s culture, these self-referential systems were utilized, right? To a certain extent. And he has this great, a great anecdote of this, this drug dealer guy walks around and just hums these songs, and everybody will just get that song stuck in their head. They'll start humming it. You know, of course, he's this gray junkie that just kind of slides in and out and no one even notices him. But he has all these people implanting these different songs in people's minds. But actually what he's doing them is bringing them to junk, right? So for Burroughs, the way out of this addictive cycle is through becoming, you know, fighting with heroin, you know, becoming an addict, becoming a junkie. And that's exactly what he's talking about, is inoculating yourself. You know, and so this socialization is very similar to this process of basically what Cameron is talking about, where you install this, you create this self-replicating mechanism that can be re-stimulated and redeployed externally, but it's been implanted inside the mind of the individual. And in fact, the individuals themselves, you know, and he says it's the therapeutic function. So this therapeutic function can be just reactivated or will become an autonomous process within the consciousness, right, of the person. This is from Walter talking about some of his experiments with sound and light. Quote, when the stimulus is first presented, as far as the subject is aware, it might imply anything or be implied by anything. But as flash succeeds flash in monotonous series, the possibility of significance is dismissed. That is, unless the whole situation takes on a peculiar character of pleasure or discomfort, then the response may augment and spread. But basically they will go into this hypnotized sort of hallucinatory state where they can no longer differentiate reality from fantasy, right? They're no, and this is from this flashing light experiment, but what I'm sort of proposing here, which I'll end up on, is that this is what I think sort of lies behind some of the stuff that I'm alluding to with these different phenomena. I think this is, if you look at it in the macro case, whether you're looking at pigeons and the influence of how you disrupt pigeons, you know, behavior and sense of, you know, even their reward mechanisms, you know, can be messed with different types of stimuli. But when the stimuli becomes unconscious, right, when it's no longer consciously perceived, but sort of washes over, then it can induce this sort of semi-hallucinatory state, right, this process of derealization or depatterning, right, deconditioning. I guess I'll stop there. If you want to throw in some other points, I mean, hopefully I just kind of try to give a little overview, but it's a super fascinating subject. it's really interesting in that, you know, these punk guys who were all about, you know, using noise, you know, Jacques Attal, who's this social theorist, describes the connection of noise and violent sound with human sacrifice. It's the relationship of sound or music. It's this, it's the oralization, the sonic reference of human sacrifice, right? So this sacrificial essence coming through the punk, the noise, you know, all this stuff. This, so you know, I mean, this sort of destructive aspect that noise can have on the human organism, the dulling of the mind, the emotional responses that are conditioned. So, anyways, hopefully not too dense. Go ahead and throw some stuff in there, man.
Well, you know, it's so. Is this pretty much the summary, or can the audience expect more of this?
Well, I would say that. What I did is kind of, I gave an overview, and it'd be kind of nice to, there's a lot more detail I didn't get into, but hopefully if, you know, people followed me so far, I can kind of clarify it. Because again, when you really have to take a sort of a multidisciplinary approach, right? You're not looking just at, you know, one type of phenomenon, listing in this or memory or social identification, but you're really looking at a very broad scale, you know, intergenerational, multi-tiered sort of very interesting system. And again, the extent is what, you know, Burroughs, it really seems to me that what he did is took patterns, Cameron's deconditioning, depatterning process, he did those experiments and basically offered that as the basis for the new counterculture. Offer that as the ultimate basis of liberation, right? The ultimate psychological liberation is actually becoming a self-programmer, becoming a doing your own. You don't have to go to, you know, McGill University and get locked into the tank. You're going to do it yourself. And he has detailed and elaborate instructions on how to do that in his books. And even he says, I tell us, this is dangerous. Think before doing this. And he talks about how to, you know, start to detemporalize, to, you know, separate the word from its reference, to you know, et cetera. So, wow. Anyways.
All right. Well, yeah. We'll have you back on in the next week or two and go into a part three on this. And it's just, you know, it's interesting seeing a whole new level of, you know, of this, because we've started all the way back, you and I did, what was it, 3 years ago? well, we did, you know, first... I can't even remember the order now. First we did Music, Mind Control, Psychobiology. Then I think we did The War of the Worlds. And then we went into Secret History of FM Radio, and then the Grateful Dead. And so it's been, you know, several years of research and laying all of this stuff out. And it's a, you know, pretty intricate to follow along, you know. And we've had, what, 25, 30 shows together now trying to, you know, expose all of this. And it's a lot of material for people to go through and try to get their heads around, but they, you know, they still need to try to do it. And I want to thank Uncommon Conspiracies for donating a couple of times. I really appreciate that. Other folks out there watching the show, please donate. Also, please support Hans. Hans has a donate button on his website, hansutter.com. Please also, you can find a donate button or Bitcoin donations on GnosticMedia.com. There's a big thing right up at the top there. Thanks so much, everyone, for supporting the show. See you next week. Hans, thank you so much. Did you have any last words?
Yeah. No, I just appreciate people, you know, being interested in this. And I guess my goal with this is to make it in a certain way that you can actually really directly see the impact and also start to make direct types of, you know, awareness and things like that to, I mean, both, you know, to understand some of the mechanisms, how they work, but also I think to really start to be able to kind of pull it apart. But hopefully I want to actually provide a way to create some type of congruity, because I'll be honest, you know, I started to realize that some of these things are been operating in myself, right? I started to notice some of these things that I'm like, holy, when I started to study this, I'm like, holy shit. I'll swear. Hey, holy
hell. It's all right. It's my show. You can swear.
It's pretty wild, but hopefully people,
kids, plug your ears. He said, holy shit.
Yeah. You know, but,
So you know what I, if you could, on the next installment, to try to give the audience real world examples so that we can grasp and begin to catch it ourselves when it's being, you know, when we're getting caught in it or it's being done to us.
Yeah. Well, I mean, one of the interesting things is you start to notice how this is the what we call the popular artificial culture, and all these other things are working in various ways. And you see, even if you're not caught in it, just starting to be aware of it. And you can also notice how it's influencing other people. I think what's good about this is, you know, you don't have to become a heroin junkie and, you know, look at flashing strobe light patterns in order to break free. I think you can break free by, you know, starting to repattern the consciousness or, right. You know, so.
And begin to think and question and look at things, study them before you think you know something, et cetera.
Yeah, absolutely. So.
All right.
Awesome, Jan. Thank you so much. And it was a pleasure again talking with you.
You too, Hans. I appreciate it. Dr. Hans Etter, everyone. Everybody, see you next week. And talk to you then. Bye-bye.